Calcio Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the Friday episode of the Calcio Land Podcast. And man, do we have a lot of great stuff on the show today. I don't know how many people are still tuning in because I've been wrong really on pretty much everything this summer. I thought Ronaldo was going to stay at Juve because no one was going to pay his salary, but we're recording this morning. Allegri just announced Ronaldo's leaving Juve. He'll be heading to Man City. So we'll be talking about that quite a bit at the top with Alex. There's a couple more days of a transfer, so we'll do a little bit of analysis on recent moves and a couple of things that could happen in the last days of the season. Friday before Serie A matches. So, of course, we have 1,000 names on deck. And I have to say, we have two outstanding guests. I know I say it all the time, but I think these are really topical this week. I'm very excited. It's been a long time since we had Alex Frosio from Gazzetta dello Sport on. He's kind of our coaching expert. So we had a great chat that I recorded on Wednesday with him. This was before all the Ronaldo stuff really broke, but I wouldn't say it's dated. And then at the end, we have my dear friend Andrew Barker. He did an outstanding job paying tribute to Charlie Watts of the Rolling Stones. But we have to start with Ronaldo. So, Alex, literally right before we started recording, as I said, Allegri at the press conference for the Empoli match confirmed that Ronaldo is leaving Juve. So, Alex, I remember so clearly when we were recording our podcast when Ronaldo arrived, I was very skeptical Juve was going to sign him literally on the day that it happened. When I saw Andrea Agnelli get on a plane to go to Greece, I was like, oh, maybe he's going on vacation. Never did I still was in denial that he was going to get Ronaldo. So let me ask you this. We've covered him on the pod. You also have a perspective outside of Serie A, but I'm curious of your thoughts because I know you do like Ronaldo. He is one of your guys. How are you going to remember these 3 years in Serie A for him?
It's a good question. A bit uneven. And of course, I'm grading that on Ronaldo's scale. Like for anyone else, especially the stats he put up, it was a great tenure. For anyone else, it's a great tenure. Take Messi out of it as well. And he did amazing there. He still won there, obviously. He did add to his trophy cabinet, and he scored a lot of goals, and he had big clutch moments. So I'm definitely not going to say that it was a failure or that it ruined his legacy. It didn't. It didn't. Definitely didn't. If anyone's saying that, I think they're probably a hardcore Messi fan or they're just super cynical. So I still view his time in Serie A as overall a success. But it could have been a bigger success, that's for sure. We said forever, David, that if Juve didn't win the Champions League, it got to the point where it was almost a failed season. That's just where their standard went. And, of course, they got Ronaldo, maybe for a handful of reasons. You always point out, David, that Juve are by far the most modern club, right? And they're always trying to appeal to not just Italy, not just Europe, but the whole world. So getting Ronaldo can help there. Fine, fair. But still, they got Ronaldo first and foremost to win the Champions League. That didn't happen. So once again, if you're a really cynical fan, and maybe cynical is the wrong word, but like if you're really, I guess, more cutthroat than I am in this moment, then you'll say, well, they got him to win the Champions League. They didn't win the Champions League. It's a failure. But it's not. But I get why someone might say that. But it could have been a bigger success. David, the big thing I take away from it is like, maybe it's because of the managerial changes while Ronaldo is there, but I do feel like his time there lacks identity. I don't even fully know what I mean by that, but like, usually when a player's at a club, I can attach that player to like the manager that was there or a teammate he had, or just like a few moments that felt cohesive or similar. And with Ronaldo, it feels a bit random. Like, I do, of course, remember him at Juve with multiple people, like his teammates, say a Dybala, and then, of course, having Maurizio Sarri. But still, Andrea Pirlo, it's not a time where it was all that even. Like I said, that's literally the first word I used when you gave me this question. I said uneven. So his time at Juve does lack identity to me, which I know might sound like a weird phrasing, but it just feels a bit confusing, I guess you could say. But with all that said, like if you peel back the curtains and you look at the analytics and you look at the statistics, you can't chalk it up as a failure. But once again, I guess if you're going off of like Ronaldo's insane standard for himself, maybe you could, because like a huge GOAT equivalent is Tom Brady, right? In terms of how disciplined Tom Brady is with his body at this age, in terms of what Tom Brady expects from himself at this age. And I got to think that if Brady doesn't win a Super Bowl at this point, he views that season as a failure. So perhaps you can chalk it up as that, but at least for like a normal person, not a failure, but not a big success. And once again, really lacked identity to me. But then again, overall, I'm sure it was still good for Serie A. How could it not be, having Ronaldo in your league for a few seasons? So yeah, as you could tell, my answer was pretty uneven, David, but I hope it made some sense. What about you?
Very good job, Alex. I enjoyed it. Before I get into, you know, my thoughts, I also want to read something that my friend Maurizio that runs the Around Turin Twitter account. It's a great web community. I think Maurizio is honestly one of the most passionate but reasonable Juve fans. So I just want to read what he wrote in a tweet because I think it ties in really well to what you said. So Ronaldo was at Juve 3 years, 134 games, scored 101 goals, can't be underestimated. The other thing I would add is he was barely injured. We've seen a ton of players go into Juve medical. Ronaldo was very reliable at Juve. Maurizio goes on, three different coaches and many issues, midfield to start with. You probably arrived at the wrong time, and this is possibly the biggest regret. Thank you, Chris. Time to move on. A pity you left in this way. We deserve more than this. Now, I think that sums it up really, really well. Because I always said I thought Ronaldo did his part. And we can point to the Champions League and very fair. But for a while, he was the only player that had scored past the group stage for Juve. Chiesa broke that streak against Porto. But like for 2 years, he had put up a ton of goals. I think that match against Atletico Madrid, probably his signature moment at Juve, the one that sticks out. So I think performance-wise, he did his part. It's undeniable there. Now, I don't love the way he's leaving, and I think him turning in a transfer request August 26th and having his agent, you know, doing all he can to find him a team, you know, talks maybe a little bit to his current situation. But that's really not what I want to talk about. I want to look at it more from Juve's perspective. And this morning when I woke up, I read Marco Jara's article on Gazzetta dello Sport. He handles the financial aspects. And I think he hit a lot of interesting thing. And I want to paraphrase a couple of the points. What Marco said at the top was really interesting. You look at where Juve was when they signed Ronaldo. You pointed out that come really close to winning the Champions League, they were trying to get over the hump. Does it make sense to buy the best player in Champions League history to do that? Absolutely. On top of that, Juve was looking for a way to bridge the gap with the super clubs revenue-wise. So they were looking to compete with the Bayern, the PSGs, the top PL club, the Real Madrid, and the Barca's of the world. And they figured the best way to do it was to kind of tap into the global market more. Made a ton of sense to go get Ronaldo. I've said this many times. You know, I grew up in Italy. I'm based in the United States. I had never seen Juve talked about as much as they were when they were linked to Ronaldo and when he arrived. I'll never forget. It was a World Cup, I think quarterfinal or semifinal. I was at a bar with some friends, and at halftime, all they were doing was talking about Juve. That never happened before. You look at the social media, how many followers it went up. I mean, it's undeniable that he brought a lot of eyeballs. Now, did Serie A do a great job of capitalizing on Ronaldo? No, they didn't. Not surprising at all. Juve, on the other hand, I think in a lot of ways benefited. But let's look at the results on the pitch for Juve. And I'm not really so much blaming Ronaldo here. He is part of it. I'm blaming more Juve. When they arrived, you know, they were on this streak of winning Scudetti. They barely win with Sarri. 2 years ago, last year, they finished fourth. So the Scudetto streak ends with Ronaldo on board. In the Champions League, they never got past the quarterfinals with him. So result-wise, I think team-wise, it's hard to argue that it worked out well. I just think Juve's plan was not a good plan to surround Ronaldo. I always thought Juve couldn't afford Ronaldo, and maybe for once I was right on the Ronaldo subject, because it really was very hard for them to assemble a team. I'm going to get to the Marotta angle because I want to close on him, because to me he's the only clear winner here. So Marotta's kind of against the Ronaldo move. Juve's like, no, this is what we need to do. We also want to be younger at the director level. So what was Juve's plan to afford Ronaldo, which cost them, you know, 58 million in wages before taxes, plus his amortization, which was about 25 to 30 million a year. So he's costing them over 80 million a year. That's a ton. So what was Juve's plan to try to have a good team around them? A lot of Bosman deals, no transfer fees. Emre Can already gone. Nobody wants Ramsey at all. He's one of the worst contracts in football. Rabiot, okay, pretty good move there. But this payroll is huge. Last season, I've pointed out many times that so many of Juve's decisions culminated with them having a novice at the coaching position in Pirlo and a payroll 80 million above Inter. And there's only last season, Inter won the Scudetto. There's only seven teams in Serie A that have a payroll over 80 million. That was the difference between Juve. So that plan clearly did not work. So on top of the Bosman deals, they tried to do some swap deals to kind of help their bottom line with Plusvalenza. Disastrous results. They lose Spinazzola, who granted is hurt a lot, but clearly a good player. And they got Luca Pellegrini in return. And Luca Pellegrini does not look like someone who can even maybe be a bench player at Juve. And then the Arthur Pjanic swap, which, look, I never was a Pjanic guy, but Arthur's remaining amortized value is just absolutely insane. And he's another player that no one wants. So that's how Juve was like, this is how we're going to afford Ronaldo. This is how we're going to be able to give him a competitive team around him. That clearly did not work out. Now, in Juve's defense, and we've pointed this out a few times, the COVID impact, definitely a big deal, because they had this window of 4 years of having Ronaldo, which ended up being three, where they were like, okay, we need to capitalize on his time here to try to increase our revenues. So they lost no fans in the stadiums. They had increased the prices at Juve Stadium. So they lose out on that. Marketing not as strong during the COVID years. And then the other thing that really hurt them financially was not doing well in the Champions League, because they were banking on revenues from the Champions League while having Ronaldo on the team. So more than Ronaldo, I blame Juve. So if we were to rank, who lost more? Because to be honest, and I get your point on Ronaldo, legacy-wise, they're going to be the gold. But I can't help but think that'll, and you're right, there's a lot of people that don't like him. It's all about narrative. And I say all the time, I've realized in the past few months that honestly, a lot of times we're not arguing on facts. We're just arguing on who we like. And, I'm going to tell you my biases. I like Marotta, and maybe because I like Marotta, my analysis is all skewed this way, but I try to back it with facts. So I feel that, if you look at it, if you're a Ronaldo guy, you're going to point to some things and ignore the rest. If you're not a Ronaldo guy, you're going to just use what's convenient for you. So I'm going to try to kind of look at it that way. But I want to close on the fact that I don't think anyone looks particularly good here. The one guy who looks great is Marotta. I continue to say the minute, when Marotta was still at Juve, Juve were known as the team that planned, that did moves ahead of time, that they were two steps ahead of their competitors. And now they're just a reactive club who's like desperate to make moves, that they can't squeeze in without real plans. So now they find themselves August 27th, Ronaldo's gone. Let's see how they replace him. But to me, this looks really, really disorganized. Marotta, on the other hand, he ended a Juve streak of a Scudetti one at Inter. It's not his fault that Inter's ownership didn't back him. He's forced to replace Conte, Hakimi, Lukaku. I think he did a really good job with that. And Juve, on the other hand, looks really like a disorganized mess. And I think today, the fact that it was Allegri at a press conference announcing basically that Ronaldo's leaving and it's not one of the directors or Andrea Agnelli, not great either. But I think that also speaks volumes to the management at Juve. And I just want to close on this. Look, Alex, we've talked about it ad nauseum. I've been saying for years, don't take anything that's said publicly on transfers, you know, literally, because it means nothing. But my God, has Nedved ever said that someone's staying? And then they did. He said, Sarri, Pirlo, now Ronaldo. It's just incredible. He really wins the prize for that. So we could go on Ronaldo for a while, but I want to shift gears, Alex, and talk a little bit about Tammy Abram. I hopped on the Mourinho Roma bandwagon last week. I'm saving you a spot. You know, I'm not a Mourinho guy like you, but I'm really, really intrigued by what's going on at Roma. I love Tammy. I've loved him for a while. We also talked about it with Alex Frazio. He told us about a scout near and dear to him who loved Tammy. So what did you make of the first game, Alex? How excited are you? What was the reaction to when the Chelsea Hammers?
Yeah, I was really excited for Tammy. Loved it. I mean, he played with passion right away, which is something that we know Tammy is good for. He always plays with passion, but it was really awesome for me to see, like, in less than a week, because, of course, he had played, he had started in that game for Roma in less than a week's time of him being there. So I love just seeing him get the start and obviously not look afraid. To be able to get two assists in his debut is fantastic. But, like, he looked good. It looked like he fit. He had a nice dribbling move and everything. Like, it wasn't just the two assists. He definitely looked good and active. Now, granted, like, still didn't get himself involved throughout the game. Like, he didn't have a lot of touches. I think he had under 20 touches. But he made them count. He totally made them count. And when you contribute with two assists and a win, and like I said, you have been there for really less than a week, that's great. I mean, if that's early days, and obviously I know the game got interesting, Zaniolo eventually gets a red. If you can get better within this side, and let's be real, David, like you just said, I know I'm not the biggest fan of Mourinho, maybe his style, but you know that they should be solid. They should be solid back there. So if Tammy can just be a constant nuisance to the opposition, they can look quite good. Like, I think they can actually be a well-structured side. But let's not get it twisted. Like, Roma need Tammy to be really good, in my opinion. I'm not saying they have a bad squad around him, but they certainly need him. I mean, doesn't that show that he starts right away for them? Like, they definitely need him. And the part that excites me about that is, once again, Tammy is not a player that is very afraid. He really takes things head on. And I hope if Roma fans came away with one take from that game, who probably didn't know Tammy as much. If you knew Tammy, maybe you weren't surprised. But if you didn't know Tammy all that much and you watched that game, I wouldn't want the two assists to be your takeaway. I would want the fearlessness, the passion, just how involved he is. And yeah, like even if he's called offside or perhaps a teammate doesn't pass it to him, he looks very animated, but I guarantee you it's not a toxic thing. No offense to Morata. It's not an Alvaro Morata thing. Morata could just be a sulker and a moaner. Tammy is just passionate. I think all the Chelsea players would tell you, no, he's great to play with. So if he throws his arms up or something like that, it's just pure passion. It's not the whole Ronaldo thing, which, by the way, Ronaldo has earned. Yes, he has earned the right to be maybe the biggest moaner at his teammates. But no, with Tammy, it's just pure, pure passion. I've said it a million times, and I'll leave Serie A / Roma fans with this. I've said it a million times to my Chelsea following, but I'll say it again. When Tammy was just a young kid at the academy, and probably Mourinho was in charge, to be honest, but let's just say it was like the Chelsea seniors that everybody kind of remembers. And John Terry obviously was still captain, leader, legend. And his center back duo a lot of the time was with Gary Cahill. There was a great interview of Terry saying, oh man, when Gaz, aka Gary Cahill, and I would just be looking for a little bit of a day off in training, especially when we would see the younger kids come over to train with us, we usually would be like, ah, this will be easy. We barely have to try. And then when we would see it would be Tammy, we'd be like, oh, are you kidding? This guy's just going to run us up and down the pitch the whole entire time. And he was saying that he takes scoring goals in training almost just as seriously as scoring them in games. And you got to love that stuff. You got to love that stuff. And I'm sure Mourinho does as well. So yeah, David, I guess my overall answer is he looked kind of at home. Like, he definitely looked like he was comfortable there. He was excited to be there, and to get two assists right away is great. Cause by the way, he'll get goals as well. So he can just,
well, I'll tell you one thing, doing well at Roma, and Totti has always said that winning a Scudetto there was better than winning the World Cup. And I'm sure he had a great time after that debut. If it keeps going this way, I think it's going to take Chelsea to pay him $80 million on top of Roma to bring him back, because he's going to love it there so much. So good for him. I loved it. And again, you know me, I'm not a Mourinho guy, but this Roma thing is really getting contagious with me.
Yeah, well, you know what? If Willian decides to go to Milan, I'll maybe jump ship. I'm already not feeling great about how quickly I pledged my allegiance to Milan, but whatever. I'm already a plastic within Serie A, it seems, so I'll jump ship if I have to. I just also love that, by the way, Tammy technically outplayed Vlahovic, and it's no hit on Vlahovic, right? Obviously.
Yeah, I agree.
But it's just like everybody's talking about Vlahovic this summer, and even Chelsea fans were like, if we can't get the top tier guys and Tammy's on his way out, let's go get Vlahovic. And I wasn't even totally against that, but I just love that Tammy kind of was the one to cement himself. And like, by the way, as I should have mentioned, the two assists happened, but also the whole drawing of the red card happened. So, you know, he's a very active player. He's not a stagnant player. He's fun to watch. So, all right. Well, David, what certainly is fun to do is to talk about transfers. And my God, this could be a segment that could last forever. But let's make it very specific here to Serie A. David, did Inter make the right choice going for Correa over Belotti?
Yeah, so I'm going to say in the short term, absolutely. If you told me, you know, 1-2 years from now, maybe Belotti was a better fit, and I say this because of Zeko. And by the way, I think there was a lot of revision. Like, as great as Tammy was, I read people saying, oh, Roma finally has a striker that makes his teammates better. I thought that was a little bit harsh on Zeko, because we also saw in his debut at Inter what he did. But long and short of it, for that reason, I think in the short term, absolutely Correa makes more sense. Had Belotti come in, I see him and Zeko really as alternatives to each other. It's not surprising that a lot of Roma fans actually were clamoring to get Belotti at the beginning of the summer when it looked like Zeko was leaving. But Correa, to me, checks a ton of boxes for Inter. He knows Simone Inzaghi. They were together for 3 years, had played great for him. He fits their team tactically better. He can play with Lautaro. He can play with Zeko. He can play with both of them as needed. And he arrives on a good deal. Granted, Inter's paying $30 million, but they are paying it on a loan with option to buy. They are diluting that payment. I was on a show with Alex Don on Calcio Connection. He pointed out that in a way, this is a win for everyone. Lazio also now have money to spend, and they've been adding players now, although it was a loan with option to buy. They know that money is coming. So in a way, really, everyone wins here. Correa didn't hide the fact that he does like Inter quite a bit. So I think it's a great move for Inter. Now, I think some people have gone a little bit overboard saying that Inter now is better than last season. Hold your horses. I thought people were way too harsh on Inter's chances when Lukaku was sold. I said it on the day it happens. I still see them as Scudetto contenders. I certainly see them as a lock for top four. And I wouldn't go so far as saying that they're better than last season. But I think Marotta and Ausilio really had an amazing summer. I think Correa is just a great fit, especially in the short term. So, yeah, they have a really nice attack now. It's not great for Belotti. Let's see if he resigns with Torino. I really wouldn't want him to go abroad. You know, this would have been a pretty good solution for him to go to a big club in Italy. So let's see what happens there. But specific for Inter, and especially this season, Correa coming on board helps. Look, the impact of Ronaldo leaving Juve on their Scudetto chances, you know, there's a lot of thoughts on how that would go. But I would say adding Correa makes Inter even more of a challenger for the Scudetto, and I think more so than Belotti, because he really would have been an alternative more to Zeko. Let's say Dzeko get hurt. I think you can roll with Lautaro and Correa as your main strikers up front.
Okay. All right, David, let's move on to this. How impressive was Fiorentina landing Torreira?
Well, look, you know, if he's anything close to the player he was at Sampdoria, I think this is an absolute home run. Because people that have been listening to the podcast know that, to me, there's two levels to a transfer move. One is upgrading on what you have. So, okay, you had a crappy keeper, you get an average keeper. Good. That's an upgrade. But to me, how you really make up ground in the standings is once you start signing players good enough to start for your competition. So if you have a crappy keeper and you buy an average one, but the teams you're trying to compete with have good keepers, guess what? You improved a little bit, but probably not much compared to the others. You look at Serie A, if Torreira is anything like the player he was at Sampdoria, and he's not old, there's certainly reason to believe he can. You could make a case that Torreira could start for pretty much any team that finished ahead of Fiorentina last season, bar for maybe Inter or Milan. Inter, you know, have that midfield that works really well as a unit. Milan have Kessié and Bennacer. So, look, you know, he's not better than that, but short of that, he could start for Juve, could start for Lazio, could start for Roma if he's the player at Sampdoria. So absolute home run. I haven't been shy of being critical of Fiorentina and Comiso on this podcast. You know it, Alex. Listeners know it. But I think this summer they did an outstanding job. Because you look at Serie A, you can make a case that really hardly anyone improved player-wise. Coaching-wise, yes. Player-wise, you can make a case that almost everyone got worse. Fiorentina clearly makes a case that they are better. Sure, they lost Ribéry, but he was older. They replaced him with Nico Gonzalez. He looked good in his debut. Highly rated Argentine player. Like Comiso said, someone who's going to have transfer value down the road. They hold on to Milenkovic. They hold on to Vlahovic. They bring in Nastasic, and they look like bring him back, and it looked like they were bringing him in to replace Milenkovic. He replaced Pizzella instead, so good move there. And they have Quarta at center back, who's really good. So they have a solid defense. And right back, they're bringing in Odriozola from Real Madrid. Nice move for Fiorentina. And they have an upgrade at coach with Italiano. So look, you know, I could say Atalanta and Roma, maybe better player-wise as well. But Fiorentina, no doubt about it. They are certainly better. So kudos to Comiso and the club. I think a lot of these moves make a ton of sense. To Torreira on a loan with option to buy, totally $16 million. Sounds like a fantastic deal to me.
Okay. All right, David. They're still my club as of right now for Serie A. So what do you expect from AC Milan in last days of the window? And careful with the players, you say.
Yeah. So I had a chuckle. So just to give you guys some background, it wasn't Andy Marzio signed from Fabrizio, but I saw someone tweet that Milan was interested in Willian. So I immediately sent it to Alex. So let's see if that's actually true. I don't think so, but I got a good chuckle at it. Look, Milan are active. Florenzi arrived. Pellegri arrived. I think Pellegri, it's incredible that already 3.5 years have passed, or 4 years have passed since Pellegrini's agent met with Mirabelli when there was talk that Pellegrini would eventually go to Milan, arrives 4 years later. Look, he's been injured a ton, but has upside. Let's see what he does. I think Florenzi is the opposite. You're not really getting him for potential. He's reliable. He helps cover multiple roles. Good move. They're bringing back Bakayoko. We saw that happening. You know, the other thing that's interesting about Torreira, and you look at how many teams in Serie A needed a defensive midfielder. Granted, Milan probably wouldn't have wanted Torreira because he's a starting caliber guy, but so many teams were interested in Bakayoko, and Milan end up getting him. But Fiorentina got a great defensive mid. I know there's been talk on the option to buy on Bakayoko. I wouldn't, that number doesn't even matter to me at all. The odds of Milan redeeming him are slim to none. I just feel like Bakayoko is a player that will be continuously loaned out. But good move. They need him because Kessié and Bennacer are going to be, you know, in the Africa Cup in January. They're trying to bring in another midfielder, Corona from Porto, probably a little bit too expensive. Adli from Bordeaux, they met with his agent. There's buzz on Messias from Crotone, although he's also linked to Torino. So they'll bring in another offensive weapon. You know, I talked about it on Tuesday pod. For Milan fans, I thought that first game against Sampdoria, it couldn't have gone better. Maignan looked really good. Milan fans have confidence in him. So Brahim Diaz, number 10, scores. I think there's a lot of reasons for Milanisti to feel pretty optimistic right now.
All right. Fair enough. Still fully in the Milan seat for now. All right, David, any under-the-radar moves that deserve more attention?
Yeah, so let's talk about the bottom of the table a little bit. Genoa looked really bad against Inter. They were always active on the market. I thought they did pretty well. They're bringing in two pretty intriguing players. Maksimovic, who not long ago was very highly rated Torino defender at Napoli, didn't work out great, but solid defender. Him and Ben Hootsen, who they got from Inter, intriguing combo at center back. At striker, they bring in Nzola, and Caicedo coming from Lazio, more options up front. So look, Genoa are kind of like a fantasy team. If you did like a draft with very little money, they keep changing the team every year, but some intriguing players there. Verona needed a striker. They get Simeone's son, pretty solid Serie A striker for the bottom of the table. He was at Cagliari last season, arrives at Verona. And shout out to Empoli, because here on the podcast, we talked a lot on how maybe Venezia was positioning themselves as the strongest newly promoted team. I no longer believe that. I think it's Empoli. They bring in Tonelli, the center back, who was at Napoli and Sampdoria. He had been there in the past, solid center back. Tina Monti, young striker from Inter. And they look pretty, although they lost, they look pretty intriguing against Lazio. I got to say, the Pinamonti thing, what shocked me is his salary. His agent, great job, because he was on over 2 million net at Inter, and Conte never played him. So kudos to his agent. I have a feeling Inter's picking up part of his wages at Empoli, but a very nice move there. I think Empoli, I would say now, are the newly promoted team to watch. And then finally, the names that Juve are linked to as potential replacements to Ronaldo, it looks like Moise Kean is the most likely. There's been talk about Scamacca. Man, that would be quite the downgrade there. I'm sure there'll be some big name older strikers offered to Juve. So let's see what happens. And the last plot that I want to say on the Ronaldo thing, and I should have included it earlier, is, man, look at the coincidence that, say, a Spurs sell Harry Kane to Man City, Ronaldo never leaves Juve, at least not to City. And I guess it was the sporting director at Spurs, none other than Fabio Paratici, who was the architect of one of the architects of bringing Ronaldo to Juve. Marotta disagreed with it. And in a way, Paratici, with Kane staying at Spurs, opened the door for Ronaldo to leave, which I found very interesting.
All right, David. So now let's transition to our next segment, and you just mentioned the name Ronaldo. And of course, our next segment is game predictions with 1,000 names. And unfortunately, it looks like we have to retire. Well, I can't make 1,000 names retire this, but I'm going to assume that he can no longer say that Ronaldo has missed a penalty or Ronaldo will miss a penalty. So I'm a little bit saddened. Maybe actually the worst part of Ronaldo leaving Serie A is we don't get 1,000 doubling down every single time we do this on Ronaldo missing a pen. But all right, let's transition. Let's move on to game picks with you and 1,000 names. Who are you guys picking?
Yeah, great stuff. Yeah, the Ronaldo sbaglia rigore. I can't tell you how many times people tweeted me on the rare occasion that he missed one or before he took one. So shout out to 1,000 names. He did a great job with that. Let's see what he's got planned for us. So you guys know the gimmick by now. I ask 1,000 names, give me 3 predictions. He picks the games. I read his picks, then I make mine. First up, Juve hosting Empoli. 1,000 names has 1-1. Goals by Morata and Pinamonti. Good segue, 1,000 names. And he says Dybala is going to miss a penalty. He says the stadium is going to boo Agnelli and they're going to miss Ronaldo, who is dreaming of winning the Champions League with Manchester City. And he says Andrea Zolli is going to dedicate the point to Sarri, who was a former Empoli coach, and that Juve's new director, Arrivabene, who arrived from Ferrari is ridiculous and not in a good way. In Italian, Juve Empoli 1-1, Morata, Pinamonti, Dybala sbaglia rigore, lo stadio fischia Agnelli e rimpiange Ronaldo che sogna la Champions a Manchester, Andrea Zoli dedica il pareggio a Sarri, arriva bene, è ridicolo. I'm going to have Juve win 2-1. I'll give one goal to Morata and one to Dybala. Look great in the first match. And yeah, I'll agree. We'll give Pinamonti a game. Look, you know, a lot of people have been tweeting me about Juve and the Ewing theory with Ronaldo. Yeah, pretty interesting. Let's see what happens. But what I will say is that I think Juve is not going to miss Ronaldo as much as Real Madrid did. Now, granted, he's older, so that's not really a knock so much on Ronaldo. But let's see what happens there. But that's my prediction. I think Juve is not going to miss him as much as Real Madrid did. Next up, Inter traveling to the Bentegodi to face Verona. Thousand has Inter winning 2-0, goals by Dzeko and Lautaro. He says Inzaghi is making people forget about Conte by winning and playing well. He said Dzeko looks like a better Lukaku, is better technically. Calhanoglu is a 40 class top player, and Di Francesco is already heading towards the sack. In Italian, Verona Inter 0-2, Dzeko, Lautaro, Limone fa già dimenticare Conte vicenda giocando bene. Edin sembra un Lukaku più forte tecnicamente. Calhanoglu fuori classe, Di Francesco verso l'esonero. Look, I like Dzeko and I thought people underestimated that move, but man, that's bold. I'm so happy Lukaku's off to a good start. But I agree, Inter's going to win. Look, Verona didn't play that badly against the Sassuolo. Inter, though, look like a force to be reckoned. I'm going to go Inter, though, just 1-0. And I'll give Dzeko a goal. I think Dzeko's going to surprise people. I'm a big fan still. Last up, Torino traveling to Tuscany to face Fiorentina. He has a Fiorentina winning 2-1, braced by Vlahovic, goal by Belotti. He says that Italiano's going to dominate Juric tactically and make the city of Florence dream. And he says Nico Gonzalez is really, really good and that Cairo Torino's president is risky going down to Serie B, which has been the case for a few years now. In Italian, Fiorentina, Torino 2-1, doppietta Vlahovic, gol di Belotti, Italiano in carta la partita, Juric fa sognare la città, Nico Gonzalez fortissimo, Cairo rischia la B. I thought Torino were actually pretty feisty the first game, unlucky. I'm going to say they do a draw. And I know I've been hyping Fiorentina. I'm going to go 1-1, go by Belotti and Vlahovic. I'll agree. But I think Torino are going to get a point. I thought they played pretty well against Atalanta. So those are our game picks. Thanks, Thousand Names, for the gimmick. Ronaldo sbaglia rigore. That is certainly one of the things I'll remember on the pod. Okay, so let's get to our first interview, a really great one. You guys know that I always say one of my favorite things of the pod is bringing on journalists that you usually don't hear talking calcio in English, and Alex Frosio is one of my favorite journalists in Italy, a good friend of mine. So I think you'll enjoy it. We talked a lot about coaching, a little bit Tammy at the end, so enjoy. I'm very excited to introduce the next guest, one of my absolute favorites on Calcioland, my good friend Alex Frosio. You know, one thing that I take pride in on this podcast is bringing great journalists from Italy that you normally don't hear in English. So those of you that have been listening to us for years know that Alex is the son of a coach in Italy. He has a great passion for calcio, covers calcio for Gazzetta dello Sport, the biggest sports paper in Italy. He follows closely the under 21, always has great thoughts on tactics. So today we'll go a little bit around Serie A, talk a little bit about some young players, and get Alex's thoughts on everything that's going on. So without further ado, it's a real pleasure to welcome you back, Alex. Bentornato to Calcioland.
Thank you, David. Hi, everybody. It's a pleasure for me to be here.
Okay, Alex. So let's start with Juve, because I've known you. We've done shows during the Sarri era. We've done shows during the Pirlo year, and now Allegri is back. So Allegri is back, and not only is Allegri there, there's also Locatelli, who is a player you've been following for a while. You've been a big fan. Yeah. You've been telling us about him from the under 21, how great Locatelli is. And I thought last season he was excellent playing for the Zerbi. So tell me, in your opinion, how much do Allegri and Locatelli help solve the problems that we've seen at Juve? You know, maybe the midfield not being great. You know, the team's really not been as good the past few years. So how much do you think these two actually help?
They will help, but I'm afraid they will not solve all of the problems of Juventus. First, because let's start from Locatelli. Locatelli comes from a style of football with the Zerbi, which was and Mancini. We don't have to forget Mancini, how he played in the national team, in a very technical team. He's used to read the situation and decide what to do. He's a player that can play one or two touches. He's very good at that, but he needs movement around him. And he needs that his teammates trust him. What I mean, I made a thread on Twitter on the second goal that Juventus gets in Udine. There's one particular image when Chiellini can give the ball to Danilo in the midfield. Danilo has an opponent near to him, close to him. That's a particular situation that Locatelli is used to manage. He can receive the ball and play the ball in that situation. But his teammates must give him the ball. And so what I mean is that Locatelli is not enough if his teammates don't give him the ball. And they must learn, probably, to give him the ball, even if he's closely marked. If you know, I don't know if I
explain what I mean. But yeah, I get it.
And this is what Allegri must teach to his team. I don't want to be too exaggerated or overreact after the first match.
Yeah.
But I'm afraid that I thought that Allegri would have solved all the Juventus problems. But after the first match, after I saw the friendly match against Atalanta 2 weeks ago on 15 August. I'm afraid that it will, or it will take time, but it's a kind of it didn't change much. Allegri didn't change much. It's the usual style of football he plays, and it doesn't have the same quality he had 3 or 4 years ago, and that's the big problem, because I don't think that Sarri or Pirlo were idiots. They had qualities. They had their mentality. I prefer Sarri than Pirlo because he's more experienced. But they were not two idiots. And it's not possible that Sarri went away after being not considered at all, and that Pirlo grabbed the fourth place just because Napoli suicided himself.
Yeah.
So I think it will be more difficult than I thought for Allegri and for Juventus.
Yeah, you know, I think it's fair. And as you said, you know, don't want to overreact too much to the Udinese game. Of course, the Chesney had something to do with it, but that's definitely a very interesting point. And I do like what you said, that we shouldn't forget Mancini with Locatelli's growth, for sure. So let's talk about Inter. And speaking of not overreacting, let's not overreact too much to Genoa, because, of course, Inter, we know, does very well with Genoa. But I haven't talked to you at all since Inzaghi replaced Conte. And I have to say, I think Marotta did a great job this summer, considering Inter's situation. I really thought bringing in Inzaghi made a lot of sense. Like, he's as similar as you're going to get to Conte and Serie A. And I thought that first match against Genoa, of course, looked quite good. So what do you make about Inzaghi at Inter? Do you, and now as we're recording, it looks like Correa's coming in with Zeko. They added Dumfries. I think overall it could have been a lot worse for Inter this summer. So what do you make of them, and also specifically of Inzaghi replacing Conte?
Yes, firstly, I must say that I agree with you. Marotta did a great job. I don't agree so much with Dzeko because he's 35. He's an excellent number nine. Excellent. He can play like a regista in attack. But he's 35. He's not a player that you can resell in 1 year or two. You will have 6 months, maybe, if he doesn't get injured or something. But if we are talking about an instant team, very excellent work, excellent. Because Dumfries is not Hakimi, but he's very similar to Hakimi. Çalhanoğlu is not Eriksen, and I think that Eriksen would have been excellent in the hands of Inzaghi. But still, Çalhanoğlu already proved he can play good under Inzaghi. Say that, I think that Inzaghi can do very well because I don't want to, as we said, overreact to beating Genoa. But it's not overreacting if we think that it's the team that won the Scudetto. It's true that they lost Lukaku. It's true that they lost Hakimi. But they still have what I think is the best defense in Serie A.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah,
they still have Brozovic and Barella that are the two most important midfielders probably of Serie A. So they have an excellent block. I would have changed if I have to say I would have changed the goalkeeper. But it's my opinion.
Well, I think there's a lot of Interisti that agree with that. So yeah, he's had better days, Handanovic. That's for sure.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of time ago. He had better days. But yeah, so if we start thinking that it's the team that won the Scudetto, they have Dzeko, they have Correa, they still have Lautaro, they have Dumfries. I think that I would have said that, but I think that still that the team to that must be beaten for Scudetto.
Well, look, as you said, they have a great defense except for the keeper, but now Juve seems to have a kind of a similar liability. Yeah. Last season, Inter gave up the least amount of goals. And as we know, in Serie A, usually the team that gives up the least amount of goals wins the Scudetto. So, look, I thought on the day Lukaku was sold, people were writing off Inter way too much. I saw some people saying, oh, Inter's not even going to be in the top four, which I thought was crazy. But now I'm kind of with you. I think they should definitely be considered, if not the favorite for the Scudetto right there with Juve. So now let's talk about Milan, because I've seen some interesting tweets about you, and you and I have been talking about Pioli there for a while. Because, look, a lot of teams, all the top teams in Serie A other than Atalanta and Milan changed coaches, and a lot of teams – you would say upgraded at the coaching position in Serie A. But do you think Milan keeping Pioli, which obviously deserved to do, might end up being a good move for them? I was pretty impressed with what I saw in the Sampdoria match. Again, just one game. Pretty intriguing. So what do you make of Pioli at Milan? Are you impressed with what he does there tactically? Do you think he's gotten more out of this team than what the quality actually is?
Yes, at the last question, yes. I think that the quality is not so high, but he had everything he could have from this team. I'm really, really, really very impressed from what Pioli is doing, because I see a modern team. I see people, I see players changing position. I see players taking responsibilities. I see a lot of things when I watch Milan playing. I can see a lot of things, and that's a coach job. That's what a coach does. I'm really impressed. I also think that maybe this kind of football is too expensive physically, and that's why I think that Ibrahimovic will be very important, because they need to score goals. They need to score more goals than what they are doing. As we saw against Sampdoria, they dominated for 1 hour and still 1-0. you risk to draw a match that you had to win. But I'm really, really impressed from what Milan is doing. Really impressed. And they don't have so many great players, but I see Salemakers. Salemakers is not a great player, but you see him doing a lot of things. He can run on the flank. He can play like a trequartista. He can come back. He helps. He does a lot of things. Calabria was not an excellent player. Now Calabria looks like an excellent player.
Yeah, I agree.
Brahim Diaz was considered a little winger. Can we say that? Now he seems to be a midfielder, a complete midfielder, because he doesn't play only as a trequartista. We saw him many times against Sampdoria coming back, getting the ball from Magnan, the new goalkeeper that is an excellent goalkeeper. So we see a lot of things, and I really like that. I don't know if it's enough to win the Scudetto. Maybe not. But it's a very funny thing to watch.
Yeah, I totally the Salemakers. I think in a lot of ways he represents what Pioli has done. And Milan, as you said, Calabria has become a really, really good player. I think he might even be an upgrade for the Azzurri if he can play for them. And I'm like, if Leao had half of the effort and tactical intelligence of Salemakers, he'd be an absolute stud. So let's move on to the teams that did change coaches. So, and I ask you this, you know, Napoli hires Spalletti, Roma gets Mourinho, Lazio gets our friend Sarri. Who do you think fits better at their new club between these three managers?
I must say Mourinho. I don't love him his teams play, because they play for me a too conservative football. But I really like him as a coach, as a man. I would say as a character from cinema, because and I think that he was the only coach that could go to Roma. Roma is a very difficult.
It is.
It is. And in Fonseca, which is maybe better as a coach, if we talk about the kind of football, funny football, and amusing football. But Mourinho will not be eaten by Roma, by the city of Rome, by his fans, by the radio.
Yeah.
He can, on the opposite, he can use them to create something big. I don't know if I can explain myself. I think we saw it during the friendlies. We saw a lot of fouls, red cards during the friendlies against Porto, against in another match. I think that this is what Mourinho wants. He wants enemies, and in Rome you can find a lot of enemies. If it makes you stronger, it's gonna be very, very strong. That's why I say that he fits a lot, Roma. I also say that I like Sarri at Lazio, because I think he will find players that he can use in the right way. Spalletti in Napoli, as we said it many times, I told you many times, we talked about it many times with you, I think that Napoli has a great roster.
Me too.
Maybe they lost something with them, and they didn't get a Terpino.
left back. Yeah.
But they still have a great roster. Spalletti, in my opinion, I don't know. I think I like him. I liked him. I think that he didn't move so much in the last few years, and I think that in the last 5-6 years the football changed a lot, and that's what I'm afraid that Allegri will pay in his comeback to Juventus, because for example 4 or 5 years ago you didn't have so many opponents that come to get you in your half. That changes a lot. You need to be able to have the ball and know how where to play it. So So I don't know Spalletti if he can give more to Napoli than what Gattuso gave.
Interesting. Yeah, I have to say, like you, Mourinho, I've never been a big Mourinho guy, especially his style of play, but I'm really all in with what he's been doing at Roma. I mean, you obviously cover Calcio at a much higher level than I do at Gazzetta, and I feel everyone who covers Serie A should be thrilled that Mourinho is back at Roma, especially. I think it's been sensational. Yeah. For sure. So real fast, do you think our friends at Atalanta, I know you love Gasperini and Atalanta like I do, you think them or Napoli can be an outside Scudetto contender? I think kind of Juve and Inter seem a little bit further ahead. You know, maybe Milan and Roma can get in the mix. But in my opinion, Atalanta and Napoli have a little bit more than Roma or Milan. Do you see any of these two potentially challenging for the Scudetto?
I'd like to, but I'm afraid not. Because I don't know, there's something missing. I you know that I like Atalanta. I like a lot of Atalanta. The way they play, their courage, their brave. But something there's always something missing. Sometimes because they get too many goals, sometimes because I don't know, I love to see Atalanta. My father coached Atalanta, so I like them. But they still miss something, and Napoli miss something as well.
Yeah, you know, I have to say that that game Atalanta had against Torino, when I was watching, I was like, it feels like Atalanta always have five or six of these games a season where we're like, oh, they should win this one pretty easily. Yeah. They did somehow win this one. So maybe there is a silver lining that they actually won without playing well. But I agree that when I watched that, I was like, there really is that one thing missing, and I can't really put my finger on it. So you mentioned Gattuso. So let's talk about this. Fiorentina originally hired Gattuso. Then it didn't work out, him and Comiso. And then they go with a very different type of manager tactically, bringing in Italiano, who was great at Spezia. I know you were a big fan of his. You mentioned many times that, you know, it's nice to see a newly promoted team play the way Spezia did. Do you think, in a way, maybe Gattuso did Fiorentina a favor and that they might be better off with Italiano?
First of all, I would say that they're not so different, Gattuso and Italiano. They're not so different in the intention. Then what they do on the pitch is different. But in the intention, they're not too different. And I think that Italiano, I like him. I really like him. I think he has the perfect team for him. Many good players, young players, brave players. Gattuso is more, would have been more used to bigger players. And the big players don't need to teach them. They know what to do. To younger players, you need to teach them. And I think that Italiano can do that.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, I like your idea that their intention is similar and how they get to it's very different. Interesting thought. So let's talk about two teams that I thought had amongst the best managers in Serie A last season, and they moved on. So Verona, Juric is gone. They bring in Di Francesco. Sampdoria lost Ranieri, and I thought Ranieri last season did an unbelievable job there, and they replaced him with Daversa. Who do you think is worse off between these two teams? Because I have to say, it wouldn't shock me if we see these teams in the battle to avoid relegation.
If you ask me who will miss the manager more, I really love Ranieri. I love him. He's an excellent person, an excellent manager. But I think that Verona will miss Juric, because his style of play is very correct. I don't know. He's very particular. When you watch a team coached by Juric, you know that is a team coached by Juric. You know what I mean? So they will lose something. They will not be so aggressive, and that's what was Verona's strength last year, in the last 2 years, and that will be the strength of Torino this year. Sampdoria was managed by Ranieri, which is a very reasonable manager. He knows how to play, where to play. It was a very aggressive team as well, because I saw some stats and they were very, very aggressive. They will not be so aggressive with Davelsa, but they come from a more simple, in a way, simple football. Two lines, 4-4-2, quite easy. It will not change so much from that point of view. So I think that Verona will suffer more.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Okay, let's close on, before I ask you about some young players, I did want to ask you about Sassuolo. You are a big De Zerbi guy. I've heard people saying, oh, Dionisi is going to be the next great Italian manager when he was at Empoli, that in a few years we might see him as a big club. So you sound to be all in. So tell us a little bit about Dionisi, and are you excited about what Sassuolo can do with him?
I really like his choice against Verona to play with Frattesi and Lopez in midfield. That's an excellent choice. Excellent choice. First of all, because I like Frattesi, he was an under-21 player, so I love him. It's a message. It's a message. We're going to play to dominate the pitch. He played with Raspadori and Caputo as well, and two wingers. That's a very attacking. That's attacking football, and I like the way Empoli plays. I think that he finds a good base, obviously, in Sassuolo for what Zerbi did. So I like him. Sassuolo is going to be again a team to watch.
For sure. Okay. So let's close on this. You mentioned your love for the under 21. You've already mentioned Frattesi was great. So tell us about some other young players we should keep an eye on this season.
Obviously, I must say Raspadori, but we still know him.
Yeah.
He's a champion of Europe. So So we know him. I like Piccoli, that already scored for Atalanta.
Yeah.
I think that Roma has two or three excellent youngsters. Not only Calafiori, which is the best, but they have two or three very interesting players. I don't know how much they will play, but they are very interesting. And I would suggest Ricci from Empoli.
Very good player. And I know you're excited that Tammy Abraham's in Serie A. I know he was one of your guys as he's been with me. Let's close on this. What do you expect from Tammy this season?
I like him a lot. I like him a lot. He can do many things. We already saw him. I thought that it would be a problem from Premier League to Serie A, just because we are more tactical championship. But he can do many things. I love him. And I say that in football, there is only one person I trust 100%. And the first time he saw Tammy Abraham, he said, wow, he's very good, Tammy Abraham. It's my father, obviously.
Yeah, I had a feeling. Yeah. Awesome. I love it. Well, Alex, I can't thank you enough. So I always suggest, if you speak Italian, you're learning Italian, follow Alex. He has some great tweets on young players, coaches. This is why I'm very humbled to have him on the podcast. So thank you so much for doing this, my friend. I look forward to chatting calcio with you again soon.
Thank you, David.
Okay, so before we get to Andrew Barker on Charlie Watts, which, by the way, was really, really outstanding. Andrew and I have done a lot of these pods on music legends who unfortunately passed away. I think you'll really enjoy it. Let's get to our patrons. If you enjoy Calcioland, please consider becoming a patron. We do a patron episode every Tuesday. We have a Napoli Outsider, our monthly chat. We're going to recap the transfer window shortly. Always great stuff there. We have a great community. You get to ask Alex and I questions, which we are going to answer now. So if you are in a patron, you're going to hear Andrew Barker on Charlie Watts, which I think you'll really enjoy. So I'm very humbled and honored to welcome our next guest. And I say this because I always love chatting music with my good friend Andrew Barker now. He's been one of our original guests from the beginning of the pod. You know, unfortunately, when someone passes away, that's a big figure in music. My first reaction is, let me see if Andrew's available to talk for a few minutes about this. So for those of you that aren't familiar with Andrew, he's one of my favorite pop culture writers, period. He's a senior feature writer at Variety, one of the most important publications here in the U.S. on pop culture. Andrew covers music, movies. He's also a big Inter fan. So at the end, I'm going to ask him one question on Inter. But today we're here to pay tribute to Charlie Watts, the historic drummer in the Rolling Stones. So Andrew, I wish it was under better circumstances, but it's always wonderful to talk to you. So thanks so much for hopping on to the pod.
My pleasure, David.
Okay, so let's start here. And this was one of my first reactions to the news of Charlie Watts was, you know, obviously the name Rolling Stones kind of implied this. I feel like there's a lot of great rock bands out there, not so many bands that are great at the roll part of rock and roll. And when I always think of the Stones, I think of the roll part, mainly Charlie Watts drumming. So do you agree with that? And in general, when you think of what he brought to the table to the Stones, what comes to mind?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. You know, that's one of Keith Richards' great lines that he uses in interviews all the time, you know, that rock and roll lost the role. But I think he's got a really astute point there, you know, just, you know, like rock and roll as the Stones first played it in the beginning and as they kind of grew up on it, it was a different kind of music, you know. It was still at that time, it was like a recognizably like black music style. It was still basically dance music, you know. It was something that was best heard in you know, small dance halls and small venues. And the Stones were probably the most important and successful band to take that most essential style of rock and roll and slowly translate it into something that could fill these, you know, giant, enormous arenas with fireworks and everything without losing the basic feel of the music. And the consistent architect of that feel is Charlie Watts. I mean, it's Keith and Charlie because they were basically the rhythm section, but Charlie at the bedrock of it. You know, like, I think Keith always gets the lion's share of the glory as the sort of, you know, inimitable genius of the Stones, and he was, but his guitar style makes very little sense without Charlie Watts playing behind him. You know, there's two real dynamics in the band. There's the dynamic between Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, which is like a giant soap opera that has been written about to death. But to me, the dynamic between Keith and Charlie is just as interesting because, you know, both of them had these really compatible styles. They were both kind of idiosyncratic and that they were both, you know, minimalists in their approach, but they both had this sort of ability to, you know, one of the most like cliched phrases in all of music criticism is that the notes you don't play are more important than the notes you do play. Like, I mean, I roll my eyes just saying that, but with them, it's absolutely true. I mean, they had this ability to almost make you imagine that you can hear things that they aren't actually playing that are just implicit. And both of them prioritized rhythm and feel over technique and flash, and Charlie especially. And so that's what kept the Rolling Stones, it retained that ability to roll, you know, like you said. Like, I mean, you compare the Stones to someone like Led Zeppelin, you know, who are just a slightly later British band who also play blues-based music and also had a very distinctive drummer. And, you know, Zeppelin had the giant riffs, you know, that could fill the arena, but they never could swing like the Stones did. You know, you couldn't dance to Zeppelin the same way. I mean, like, not really. Like, you can like rock out to them, and I guess like strippers can dance to Zeppelin, you know. But it's not like it's not like the same thing, you know. Like, even when Zeppelin were blatantly ripping off Muddy Waters or Howlin' Wolf, they were taking the structure and the melodic formulas of a blues song, but not so much the feel of it. And the Stones always had the feel, you know, no matter how big and famous and rich and fat they got, they had the feel, you know, like you compare Led Zeppelin song Rock and Roll, you compare that to Rip This Joint by the Stones. which, and they're basically the same song. It's just like a super fast, basic rock and roll song. And just listen to the way the rhythm makes you feel, you know, like with Zeppelin, you feel the rhythm like in your head, you nod your head or in your arms, like, you know, you pump your fist to it. And with Rip This Joint, with the Stones, you feel it in your hips. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Even though they're contemporaries at this point, the same time period, there's an antiqueness to the Stones, which is the role part of it. And that's, you know, 100% due to the drummer, I think.
Wow. All right. This goes down as one of my favorite answers in over 400 podcasts here. So well played here. So let me ask you this, because I've been thinking a lot about this, Andrew, and I'm glad you brought up Zeppelin, because when I was growing up and I was younger, you know, when I thought of like great drummers, it was more like the Bonham type, Keith Moon, even Ginger Baker, of course. But like the older I get, and it seems this is also true in music criticism, it seems like, you know, Ringo Starr and Charlie Watts, like as more time passes, they're getting much more credit than, you know, I don't know if heavier is the right word, but maybe more protagonists in the song. Do you agree with that? And do you think this is also true in music criticism? Because I kept thinking, you know, for years, Ringo Starr, I would think of Paul McCartney being on Howard Stern saying, well, you know, he wasn't even the greatest drummer in the Beatles. And I feel like that kind of hurt him in a lot of ways. But now historically, people love him and Charlie a lot more. So do you think that's evolved as well, or people just appreciate them more now?
That's a great question. And yeah, I think so. I mean, especially, you know, Ringo's an interesting one, because, I mean, Ringo was, you know, I feel like he was almost never considered like a great drummer. But I mean, the thing I always say about Ringo specifically is that, like, sure, there were drummers who were more technically proficient and accomplished, but do you want them playing different drums on those songs? You know, like, would those songs have been better if there was someone playing a solo through the whole song, like Keith Moon probably would have? And I don't think so. I think they would have been worse, you know? So having the taste level to know what to play and what not to play is not going to make an arena cheer like, oh, look at Ringo, he didn't play a drum fill, you know, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you kind of need to step back a little bit and think like, wait, no, this song is perfect. Like, why would I want a different drummer on a song that's perfect, you know? Just because he's, you know, could teach at Musicians Institute, whereas Ringo couldn't, you know? So I definitely think Ringo has been, you know, kind of reevaluated in a much more positive way. Charlie, I think there's more of a baseline appreciation for him, which you see. I mean, you know, you brought up like Ginger Baker, you know, who hated everybody and hated the Stones, you know, and would not go miles within a Stones concert, but still appreciated Charlie Watts. I mean, someone dug up a letter that Charlie Watts wrote to Rolling Stone, like in the early days, where they had like trashed the album, but said that Charlie was good. And he said, that's for like, awesome. Thank you for the nice things you said about me. The other guys hope they can do better next time. You know, so I feel like there's been a baseline appreciation for Charlie that maybe he's never the hero that Bonham was or Keith Moon was, but, or even Mitch Mitchell was in some cases. But I think the appreciation for him has always been there, I think.
For sure. So listen, I know rankings and all, especially right after someone dies, a little bit weird and all, but I know you feel pretty passionately that Charlie should be ranked definitely up there. So when you think of like great rock drummers, kind of how do you see him fitting in amongst the best?
I mean, I would have said the same thing if you asked me a year ago. I ranked Charlie Watts at the very, very top of rock drummers. I mean, definitely at the top of all the British Invasion bands, and I would say at the top of all the canonical 60s bands, you know. And then when you take a wider view, it's always a weird thing to say, because when you say someone was the greatest rock drummer, then all of a sudden you're comparing Charlie Watts to Keith Moon, but also to Neil Peart and to Dave Lombardo and to like Questlove, you know. And it's like you're comparing athletes in different sports almost, you know. But if you ask me like who the greatest rock and roll drummer is, and I had to pick one person, it would be Charlie Watts. Because, I mean, part of it is just, you know, the benefit of timing and longevity, but his style of drumming to me is as close to the prototype of what rock drumming could be that could remain consistent, like through several decades of stylistic evolution. You know, like you think about like what what am I trying to say? What is it like fundamentally that distinguishes rock and roll drumming post British invasion from pre, you know, from you know, sort of 70s rock drumming from like the blues guys and the Chuck Berrys and the Ike Turners and the Buddy Hollies, like what makes it its own style, you know, and the basic like rhythms and patterns are the same, but it developed like a certain, you know, muscularity to it and a bigness to it. And Charlie bridges those two sides, I think, better than anyone. You know, I mean, because you talk about, you know, Charlie Watts was a feel drummer. You know, he's a feel and a swing and a rhythm drummer as opposed to like a pound the sticks and draw attention to yourself drummers. And when you talk about like drummers who could swing and had that feel, you know, Charlie's not the number one guy there. You know, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, everyone who played on those early Motown records and all the Muscle Shoals drummers and anyone who drummed for Booker T, like all those guys had that same feel, as strong, if not stronger, than Charlie Watts. But Charlie Watts had to contend with how much louder and bigger rock and roll got from when he started. You know, I mean, even just like the sound of the guitar, like you compare the way electric guitar sounded at the beginning of the 60s when Charlie Watts was starting out, you know, like the way Roy Orbison played or Carl Perkins played, you know, Scotty Moore on those early Elvis records. Compare that to the way it sounded at the end of the 60s with Hendrix and Page and all those guys. And there's a dramatic change. Like it's so much louder and thicker and heavier. And Charlie Watts figured out how to accommodate all those changes, like without fundamentally changing his approach. And like, what is like modern rock and roll drumming, if not that? To me, you know, like by the late 70s, like with Some Girls, you know, a Stones set list would have songs on it that were basically punk rock, you know, and they had songs that were basically disco, and they had reggae songs and they had funk songs, and yet they still played like the old Chuck Berry songs and the old Buddy Holly songs in concert, right? And so like what connects those things to me is Charlie Watts. I mean, I think he's the constant in the equation there. So I put him at the top.
Love it. Okay, before I ask you a couple of songs that you think highlight this greatness, you know, the last thing that I've been thinking about since yesterday, I was at a concert last night. I saw Wilco, Sleaf or Kenny. They paid tribute to him. And it really dawned on me that, look, the Rolling Stones had depths in the band before, but I had talked to myself and the Charlie Watts, Mick and Keith, like being immortal, like almost like Marvel characters to me. It feels like really bizarre that he's gone. I mean, this is a guy that had never missed the Stones gig since the 60s. And I know they had announced that he wasn't going to be part of this tour. So how do you feel about that? And I have to say, the other thing that I think a lot about that, and I feel that all this rock mystique and all like the Keith Mick thing is like, unfortunately, a thing that feels a lot of the past. So do you feel that in a lot of ways, this is, we've seen a lot of these stars go out, but I feel like the Stones, I always felt these guys were just going to keep going. I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, it's just so crazy. You know, I was just thinking about this yesterday, how, you know, people have been making fun of the Stones for being too old to play rock and roll, like literally before I was born, you know, like they had the Steel Wheelchairs tour.
Yeah.
It was a big joke. And I was 7 years old when that happened. Like, you know,
yeah.
And they were still playing up until like 2 years ago. It's easy to imagine they'll just be there forever. And, I mean, I tweeted this, like, when they announced that Charlie a couple weeks ago wasn't going to be playing on the tour, that I'd rather see the Stones without Mick than without Charlie, which was kind of an exaggeration. I was, you know, a little hyperbole there, I guess. But it still feels like, I mean, sure, you know, the Who have been playing without Keith Moon for decades. But it feels like one of those things, like Zeppelin, I mean, another band, you know, like I said, with a drummer that it's hard to imagine the band without, they've played, like, I think they played two gigs without John Bonham and both, you know, with John Bonham's son, literally, you know, so I feel like Charlie's importance to the Stones is identical to that. I mean, obviously they had one of their founders die and, you know, they've had a couple, you know, they had a change in bass player, change in lead guitar player, but Mick, Keith and Charlie, like that's the band, you know,
it is.
So I have a hard time imagining it without him.
For sure. Okay, before I ask you about Enter, because I'm very curious to get your take, I got to ask if you know, say someone who's somewhat familiar with the Stones, but maybe doesn't understand why, especially you, are so into Charlie Watts, what songs would you recommend he listen to?
I would tell that hypothetical person two songs. Although first I'm going to cheat a little and say that I think Charlie Watts' high watermark is the whole Sticky Fingers album. You know, there are certain Stones albums that are just kind of owned by one member. You kind of feel like, you know, the really early Stones stuff is kind of owned by Brian Jones. And I think of Exile on Main Street as sort of like a Keith Richards showcase. And Some Girls is fundamentally a Mick Jagger album. But Sticky Fingers to me is just like the Charlie Watts show. Like on every song that he really plays, you know, it's Sway and Brown Sugar and Bitch. Bitch is probably like one of my favorite drum tracks of all time. But like the one from that album I'd point to is Can't You Hear Me Knocking?
Yeah.
I think. Because, I mean, well, one, I mean, you don't have to even pay attention. You just listen to the groove. And from the very start, the groove is undeniable. But it's also, I think it's one of the best illustrations of how Charlie and Keith interacted in the way, you know, I mean, just from the very beginning, the way they wind around each other in this somewhat bizarre way on the song. Like, neither of them are kind of accenting the beats you'd expect them to accent, but the groove is just perfect somehow. And just, it's also one of those tracks where you can appreciate just, because, you know, like I said, Charlie was a field drummer. He was an instinctive drummer. And you just hear his instincts as a musician in all these tiny little things he does in the song. You know, like there's he does these tiny little bounce rolls on the snare that you almost can't even hear unless you're listening for them. But they just make the whole groove seem like it's dragging, even though it's perfectly on beat.
Yeah.
Which is what makes the song, like, it gives it that whole druggy vibe. It gives it that really sexual vibe to it. Or the way he'll just do all, I mean, just all these little things, like, this is a weird thing, but like, when the song goes into the chorus, you know, 99 drummers out of 100 would play something on the first bar of the chorus to kind of pump up the song dramatic, you know, dynamically.
Yeah.
But Charlie actually kind of, he gets, like, quieter almost for the first two bars of the chorus, and then he starts hitting the ride cymbal like you'd expect him to from the beginning, which just kind of it pulls you into the song rather than just kind of knocking you over the head. Or I mean, just the little accents. I mean, like, you know, the way he'll hit those two beats like unusually loud after Mick says, "Can't you hear me knocking?" Like it's a knock at the door, you know. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
You know, like that. I mean, just and none of that was like premeditated. I mean, that whole song was more or less like a jam, but he just took notes from what everyone else was doing and he commented on it, you know, and you're just kind of hearing that in real time, you know, just all these little touches. And then I think the other track is the live version of Midnight Rambler that's on Get Your Yayas Out.
Good shout.
Yeah, which is like. Like, I think that's the only, I mean, that song is everywhere. Like, that version of that song, you know, like, I think that version is on, like, the greatest hits albums even, you know. And you understand why. I mean, like, there's just something about that take and that performance where there's something really special. The momentum that they build up at various points on that song is just stupid. And it's like, and you can really hear, I think, more than anything else, you know, that's sort of widely available, just how much everyone is following Charlie's lead. I mean, you can just hear it, you know, like he's not keeping time. He's setting the exact level of intensity for everyone else in the band to follow. I mean, there's so many places in that song where you hear him kind of kick up a notch and two beats later, everyone else kicks up a notch. You know, they're waiting for him to tell them where to go. And he lets the song get sloppy sometimes. And then he snaps it back into attention. And it's just like, that's like just a magical performance of that song. And what's essential about it too, is like, you know, a lot of times when a band is really, really locked in with each other, you'll describe them as being like a machine, but like the Stones never sounded like a machine and they don't there either. Like they sound like one living organism, you know, like it's not precise at all. Like it's human, you know, it changes its mind. It gets distracted. It kind of comes back to attention. It stumbles. Then it picks up speed, you know, and Charlie Watts is like the whole central nervous system of this like shared consciousness. That's playing that song. I love that take. I think that those two, like if you don't hear what's special about him there, then that's fine. You know, he's not for you. I think that's what it is.
Wow. Well, listen, we've done a lot of these over the years, man. I love awesome, great stuff on Charlie. But before I let you go, I have to ask you this, Andrew, because I'm very curious to get your take on Inter. I have to say, even on the day Lukaku was sold, I was still pretty bullish on Inter. And I get it. I get fans get emotionally invested, all these big departures, and I get people that don't like Inter. It was a great opportunity to bash them. But I felt, you know, I was like, I think people are underestimating the team here. And we're recording this today. Correa's in Milano taking his medical. So let me just ask you this, Andrew. Compared to the day you knew Lukaku was leaving, how much more optimistic do you feel today about Inter?
I mean, it'd be hard for me to feel less optimistic than I did like the day I heard Lukaku was leaving. I was really upset about that, actually. I was more upset about that than I have been about any Inter departure in a long time. Obviously, the first match went amazingly well. The opposition was pretty terrible, so it's hard to gauge that much from it. But the team looked great. You know, I mean, the Inzaghi ball seems to be developing. I mean, it was a noticeably different team than under Conte, not just because of new players, but just because of the way they played. I have doubts about both Calhanoglu and Dzeko. You know, I mean, Dzeko especially, but Dzeko looked amazing.
Unbelievable.
I don't expect him to be that good the whole time. But I'm curious to see what Inzaghi makes of that team. You know, I mean, I think, you know, with Correa coming and Dzeko really being the only, like, big traditional center forward, unless, you know, Lautaro kind of changes his style, I'm curious about that because it feels like that Inter has like one, you know, 36-year-old number nine and then a whole bunch of number 10s, you know, kind of like running around him. But if Inzaghi can figure out how that makes sense, that could be really exciting to watch. I still need to be convinced a little bit when they play a better team, you know, in a couple weeks. But I mean, they look great, you know, didn't they?
For sure. Yeah. I think two combined, and look, Juve with Szczesny, I mean, maybe with another keeper, not that bad, but I think Inter fans should be pretty optimistic. But Andrew, I can't thank you enough. This was really awesome. What a treat, you know, chatting with you about stuff like this makes a lot of the other stuff really worthwhile. So thanks so much for doing it. I had a blast. I look forward to chatting with you. Again, anyone, I always say, if you want to improve your writing, check out all of Andrew's work at Variety. It's really outstanding. And thanks so much for doing this, my friend.
Of course, sir.